The Round Golf Podcast with Richard Kaufman.
Hello, welcome to the Round Golf Podcast brought to you by Red Ray and Navigate Contracting. Well, the wins, the majors, the legend that is Kari Webb. No argument, she's one of the best. And I don't know if you saw on social media to mark her 25th appearance at the Australian Open. Golf Australia, they put together a tribute where players from all over the years gave their say on, you know, arguably the greatest Australian player of all time. The reaction to that was superb and tells you exactly what her peers think of her. But before I did this interview, and hopefully there's an after effect as well, I was thinking, how well do the public know her? It was obvious how her peers felt about her. And part of this podcast's hope is you come away after listening feeling like you do have a good idea about the person in question. I think once you've listened to Kari over the next 40 minutes, you're going to hear that it's not just because of her golf that she is so popular. We talk about the significant role Greg Norman played, her distrust of the media, her rivalry, of course, with Annika Sörenstam, and her one regret, which is, you know, about the Olympics, really. Now, of course, it won't be long before the best women golfers head to California for the first major of the year, and it was at Mission Hills in 2006 where we begin our conversation.
I think it's very difficult to choose one round out of all of them. There's been many great ones. So I think the round I've picked is, I feel like, confidence building and career, not career changing, but more confidence building, I guess.
Yeah, because it came at a period where you had huge success, and we're talking about here about the Craft Nabisco at Mission Hills back in 2006. You've had huge success. You'd already won six majors by this point and countless other tournaments as well, number one money winner. But I think comparatively, I wouldn't say you were in a slump, but comparatively you'd been in a slump.
Yeah, I think some people wouldn't class it as a slump, but for me, 2005 was the first year I never won on the LPGA. I won once the Australian Masters, but that was my only win worldwide and none on the LPGA. So, and that was also the year that I entered the LPGA Hall of Fame and the World Golf Hall of Fame. So, you know, when you're living in the moment and your life is based upon results, when I was going into the Hall of Fame, I was, you know, celebrating my career, but I possibly would have regarded it at the time as, you know, not my best year.
So were you almost embarrassed?
Oh, no, I wasn't embarrassed. I knew why I was going in, and I did enjoy the celebrations. I had a really good time with that. I actually like how the World Golf Hall of Fame does it now, and you have to be 50. I definitely would have appreciated it going in at 50 than going in at 30.
Yeah, but so that week itself, as you say, the form hadn't been fantastic, and then when you've shot a 76 in round three and you're now seven behind Lorena Ochoa, do you think your chances are gone?
Yeah, well, the backstory to the start of that week, we didn't have an LPGA tournament the week before, which is probably the only time in my career that we haven't. And so I was in Palm Springs early, and my coach Ian Triggs was in town. We did a lot of work over the weekend, and I think it was Tuesday afternoon, we were on the range. And, you know, I just wasn't really happy with how I was hitting it. And one of my pet peeves is when someone says you're close. When I felt like I wasn't anywhere near close, and I hadn't really played all that well in the lead up to that week. And so, you know, Triggsy said, you know, you're close, and I'm like, I am so far from effing close.
He should know better as well, yeah. Shouldn't he, if that's one of your pet peeves.
Yeah, and I said, I'm so far from that. And I think he stayed through Thursday. So Thursday I'd shot two under, two birdies, no bogeys, but Lorena Ochoa, I think, had shot 10 under, 9 or 10 under. So
yeah, she shot a 62 first.
Yeah, so yeah. 10 under. And so I was like, even though I felt like I played reasonable, I, you know, felt like I wasn't in the tournament. And then I played well Friday to put myself in the last group with Lorena and Michelle Wee on Saturday and performed horribly, you know, didn't rise to the occasion. So really, really disappointed Saturday night. And Sunday morning I was trying to, you know, try and take some positives and like, let's just have a good last round, you know, and have a good finish. And so that's sort of the message I was giving myself before I went to the course, and then I got to the course and I had a few spare minutes before I started my warm-up, so I just sat in the locker room, just a little lounge area, and had the morning newspapers there. So I started reading the sports section of the local newspaper, and they had said, so I was starting the day 7 shots back. And I think there was only maybe 6 people in front of me being 7 shots back, so it wasn't like there was 40 people in front of me. The article I was reading was saying that Annika Sorensen was 10 shots behind, and she had a realistic chance to win that day. And I was like, well, if she's got a chance at 10 under, I've got a chance at 7 under. So it was sort of like that little fired up message that I got from reading the paper that I still didn't think that, you know, the round that was about to come was going to come. But I was like, well, if she's got a chance, I've got a chance.
But the round did come. You made 3 birdies on the front nine, and then once you birdie 10 and 11, is that the moment that you think this is on?
Yes. Especially when I birdied 11. I was a good birdie on 10, birdied 11. So I'm 5 under for the round. I've moved to 7 under. I think I'm either 1 shot or behind, but I'm close. The leaders aren't doing anything.
Well, Lorraine is falling backwards,
yeah,
isn't she?
Yeah, and no one's doing anything in the last group. So, you know, from then on, I'm in content, you know, I've got a chance to win. And, you know, it's funny. I know I birdied 10 and 11, but I can't tell you how I birdied them. But it's the different par saves that I made during that day that I remember the most as why they gave me a chance to win. I made a good par on the second that morning, and it's a straightforward par five. So I should be thinking about a birdie, but I actually had to get up and down for a par, and I made about a 6 or 7 footer. And quite honestly, if that doesn't go in, my attitude for the rest of the day is terrible because I'd played poorly the day before and now I've just started off poorly. So I make that. So that to me was a key. And then, you know, I played the next few, 13's quite a difficult par four. I played all those holes quite well. 16 is a difficult driving hole, and I'd hit it in the rough off the tee and I couldn't get to the green. The pin there wasn't the toughest pin on the green, but the greens were really burnt out by Sunday afternoon, and I had a really delicate little pitch to the front left pin, and I got that up and down. I almost holed it. So, I remember those more than I remember some of the birdies.
That's interesting, but obviously there is a standout moment.
Yes.
So you get to 18, and I think you were tied with Natalie Gulbis and Michelle Wee.
Yes.
At this point. So you come down to 18. It's a reachable par five.
For the first time ever.
Right.
It's reachable. We played the up tee there for the first time ever. And it's reachable with a good tee shot you have to hit it in the right slot to get a good forward kick.
But you'd laid up.
Well, I missed the fairway.
Right.
And I was really thinking, because we'd never played at reachable in all of my career, you know. And I'd hit a couple of tee shots from there in practice, but I'm like, I'd have to get it well down there to have a go because it's an island green. So not only do you have to make the carry, you've got to stop it before, you know, it goes in the water over the back. So,
sure.
Yeah, so I get there, I miss the fairway, and I'm thinking if I make a birdie and the way the leaders are going, they still had, you know, a couple of tough holes, 15 and 16 to play, and 17's not an easy par three. I'm like, birdie will maybe get me in a playoff, maybe good enough. So missed the fairway, I laid up, and I had 116 yards, I'll never forget my number, and it was just a perfect grip wedge. It wasn't a lot of wind to speak of. And, you know, I'm thinking I got to get this in close. Just hit the most pure dead straight wedge, and I've watched the replay quite a few times, and my caddy Mikey said, be right, and it lands, one bounce, spins straight in the hole. And at that stage, literally when that went in, I thought I'd won the golf tournament because I had a 2-shot lead with the leaders not doing anything. So I thought I'd hold that to win. And, you know, I can sit here and I can honestly feel the emotion still when I imagine it, how I felt it. You know, I ran and jumped into Mikey's arms, who had the bag on his back. And I think he could have, he was so pumped up too. I think he could have held me for minutes, you know, because, and I was really only in his arms for a couple of seconds. But you know, my heart was pounding out of my chest. It was, and I had tons of friends there that week. So just a really exciting moment. And I guess, you know, part of why I chose this round was it was a very un-Curry Webb reaction to a golf shot.
Yeah, I read an article of the moment. And one journalist wrote, I'm not sure what was more shocking, the eagle or Webb's reaction. Pretty much sums it up, which, if you know, if we can go off on a tangent, because the image that you give, and you've just said it yourself, was nothing like that in terms of how you've reacted to shots in the past.
Yeah.
So is that the moment then in your career where suddenly, you know, you just let it all go?
Yeah, well, I think, again, you know, my struggles weren't true struggles, but they were struggles for me. And, you know, it was just sort of 12 months of frustration, all in that one moment, sort of being released. And I think I possibly, even if the story ends where I didn't win, I still probably class that round as confident, you know, the way I feel about it, just because, you know, of the way it ended and my reaction, you know, and I just really enjoy the moment. And a lot of the great things I've done in my career, I haven't probably enjoyed as much as I should. It was almost like, well, that's why I practice. I should do that.
Just talk about that style. So the image people have of you, and obviously we're sitting here chatting, and I know from your peers that you're a fun-loving person, great sense of humour. But if I went ask people about Curry Webb who don't know you, they would think you're maybe an introverted person. You know, they see you when you've been playing behind the sunglasses. Mm-hmm. Are you media shy, celebrity shy, or are you just, that's the way you need to be on a golf course?
I think that's naturally how I am on a golf course. I think I've always been someone that doesn't get too high or too low. I think even in everyday life, you know, a good friend of mine told me they sometimes, you know, if I like something, they're not actually quite sure if I like it, because I don't, like, I'm not super excited about it. I'm happy about it, but I'm not super excited about it. And I think I am, you would class me as an introvert or shy. I was very shy as a kid. And I would say that I was media shy to start with, and then it didn't get much better when the American media didn't understand my dry sarcasm without a smile. They didn't take that well. So then I, you know, got the worst time of it for a couple of years, and I think they were trying to make me change, and I dug my heels in, and I was like, I'm not changing for anybody.
Because if I can, we're going to come back to obviously what happens next in this round, because as you say, it's not done with the hole out there. But when you're 16 years old, I know you won a tournament that took you to Florida and you got to meet Greg Norman, and he got damaged a little bit by media, didn't he? Is that something that you also were aware of?
Yeah, I think I was already wary of the media because of what, you know, he was a hero of mine, and every time he stepped foot in Australia, they found some reason to criticize him. You know, and Greg's very different to me personality wise. He's very flamboyant and outgoing and an extrovert, and you know, he wants everyone to know he's there, and he did do that. But you know, he should have been celebrated every time he came into the country, and because he came in on his private jet and flew a helicopter to the golf course, you know, it's just the Australian mentality, I think, is, you know, the tall poppy syndrome. I think the UK is I think that's where we inherited it from. So if you look at today's best players, Adam Scott and Jason Day, were influenced by Greg Norman. So we shouldn't be trying to knock him down a peg or two. We should be celebrating him when he comes home.
What was that like, though, as a 16-year-old going to... That was the first time, was it, outside of America properly or something like this?
It was the first time to the US. So I talk about not living in reality, going to Greg Norman's
place.
So
you'd won a tournament.
Yeah, I won the very first year of Greg Norman's Junior Golf Foundation. You play in all these junior tournaments throughout the state of Queensland, and all those winners go to the season ending event, and that was the first year of it. And he had said that the girls winner and the boys winner were going to get an all expenses paid trip to Florida to stay with him for a week, which was just incredible. He was there at the beginning of the week. He had Ian Baker Finch present the trophies. It was just amazing. And so to to spend the week. Yeah, and like I said, talk about not living in the real world. You know, I traveled all the way over there by myself. I was picked up by his brother-in-law and got to his house really late at night, so I couldn't really see anything, in one of his guest houses. And 7:30 the next morning, he knocked on the door and he came. I was still in my pajamas, and I'm meeting Greg Norman in my pajamas. Oh. So, but it was an amazing week, and he was so giving of his time. And, you know, it sort of was, or it is the influence to what I have now with the Kari Webb series and scholarship was, you know, my paying it forward for what he did for me.
Yeah, because let's talk about that then, because this is something you've done now for a while. You have a series, a golf series like Greg had back then, and, you know, the best winners from that get to spend time with you at a major.
Yeah, so I partner with Golf Australia in it, and, you know, they facilitate it all. It's all some of the top amateur stroke play events and also some of the Australian professional events down there. It's like a player of the year type format. They get points for how they finish. And the top two girls from that, they get a monetary scholarship, as well as they get to come to the States and spend a week with me. Every year until this year, it was the US Open this year, because of the dates of the US Open and KPMG, WPGA. We chose the WPGA in Chicago this year, but it's been fantastic. I've enjoyed it as much as the girls, I think.
Minji Lee says you gave her the confidence to make it to the LPGA. I mean, you must be aware of that, and that must give you great satisfaction.
Yeah, it does. The list of all the players that I follow on different scoring apps, most of them are the girls that have come through my series, or girls that were close to coming through my series and I'd played practice rounds with. I feel like, a big sister. I'm not going to say mother, even though some of them would. But I feel like a big sister as far as, you know, living and dying on watching live scoring if I'm not out there, out at the tournament.
Okay, well, let's go back to the round itself. So you've made this eagle. You've jumped into Mikey Patterson's arms.
Yeah.
Did you high-five the crowd a bit as well?
Yeah, then when I approached the green, because it's an island green, you got to walk. There's a grandstand, and you walk along past the Wall of Champions is right there, and all the crowd were hanging over. So, you know, I did a lap of high fives, and a few of my friends were in the clubhouse watching. They'd run down to meet me at the, the start of the bridge across. And I don't think I've ever had as much adrenaline as I did in that moment. All through walking over, picking the ball out of the hole, and then I tried to throw it into the crowd, and I was so pumped up, I threw it over the grandstand. it was such a great feeling. And then I get into the score tent, and they have the telecast on there, and literally simultaneously when I hold that shot, Michelle Wee almost held it on 16 and had a tap-in birdie. So she was at 8 under. So I had to try and calm myself down, because I'm like, at best, I'm probably now going to be in a playoff.
Yeah, we should remind ourselves, this is a 16-year-old Michelle Wee. So, I mean, there's this young buck coming along. I mean, we'd heard about her already by then, but this is the first time really at a major competing. She's made this birdie. And Lorena Ochoa, who looks out of it as well, suddenly, you know, she plays 18 incredibly. So, I mean, there was a few players there, Natalie Golbus as well, who had a chance at 18 to, as you say, force a playoff. But in the end, it was only Lorena.
Yeah, Lorena. So all three of them, Natalie laid up on 18. She had about a 12-footer, I guess.
And you're watching all this on TV?
Well, I've watched it since. I was being commentated to while I was putting on because I couldn't, because of the crowds and stuff, I couldn't actually see the 18th green. Natalie had about a 12-footer. Michelle went for the green and just went through. And Lorena hit it to about 8 feet. And the way Lorena was playing at that time, I was like, well, Lorena's going to make hers for sure. So that gets her to 9 under. And as it turned out, Michelle Wee didn't get it up and down from over the back. Natalie missed hers, but Lorena made hers.
So you're in a playoff now.
Yeah.
So, I mean, how hard is that? Because you've never been that high before.
Yeah.
In all the wins that you've had, as I say, lots of them, but you've never been that high. How hard was it then to get that focus back to you know, I've got a job to do here.
Yeah, well, I was, I think I was two groups ahead of them. So I had a good half hour. So I'd gone to the range and hit some balls and then hit some putts. You know, obviously I was still buzzing about how I'd finished, but, you know, I think that kind of helped me. And I think Lorena could see how pumped up and excited I was about how I'd finished. But I knew Lorena was much longer than me. So I knew 18 that if she got it in the fairway, she was going to go for the green again. And so I actually hit a really good drive down there. But I was nowhere near as far as her. And, you know, if I was going for it, I had a 3-wood in my hand. And this is an island green. I'd hit a couple in practice that week, but hit them into the water short. And I'd just sort of written it off as that I was possibly ever going to go for the green unless I'd had a tailwind and had less than a 5-wood in. So I'm standing there. I know Lorena's got a hybrid at best in. So Mikey and I are talking about what we should do. And I said, is there any rough over the green? And Mikey had actually, in walking the course, had thrown balls over there at speed to see if the rough stopped him from going in the water. And he said, I threw balls. He goes, I think you can hit 3-wood the, you know, left center of the green. And if it doesn't catch the slope and go right and it goes over, the rough will stop it. And so I trusted that and still not comfortable hitting a 3-wood into the screen. But I slotted a 3-wood, hit it really good, but it didn't catch a slope and it went over into the rough. But it stayed up in the rough. And Lorena hit hers a little bit. She had a good shot, but a little bit long. But she was putting. She was off the green, but putting. And then I possibly hit one of the best chips I've ever hit because it wasn't an easy up and down. In the end, I think I probably would have laid it up now just because the chip shot from over the back is not easy. I hit a great chip shot to about 6 feet, I guess. And Lorena hit a very poor putt and hit it probably 8 feet past. So she had to putt first and missed. And then I had the 6-footer to win. And it was funny, in the off season before that, in the January, I was practicing. And often on 18, you're faced with a left to right putt if you're short of the pin. And you normally are because it's all the way in the back. So when I was practicing left to right putts and saying to myself, this is to win Craft Nabisco.
Really?
Yeah. And when I'd hold the shot at the time, I was like, I guess I didn't need the left to righter to win. You know, it came back to me that I'd been practicing like that. But at the time when I had the 6-footer, it didn't pop into my head. But afterwards, I was like, I did. I made that 6-footer to win, the left to righter to win. So it was sort of I'd put that visual in my head.
Interesting. Okay. So, because I want to talk about how you were after the win as well, but you talk about there how you practiced and it came to fruition, if you like. You were one of these people, you know, you tell me otherwise, that you felt you had to keep practice. You had to be totally prepared for everything.
Yeah.
And then maybe later in your career, you felt maybe you were a bit too obsessive?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I've ever... I think golf's just an obsessive sport. you know, for me, I've always thought if you don't put the work in and you play poorly, then that's why. You don't play well when you don't work hard. So that's always been my philosophy. And now that I've, you know, backing down my playing schedule to part-time, obviously I have to try and change that mindset because I'm not going to stand out there grinding all year just to play in a handful of tournaments. So
is it really hard for you not to be in that routine?
A little bit. Actually, you know, when you're in the routine for a whole year, you'd give anything not to have to do it for a while. But then you realize when you have a bunch of time off, you're like, I don't have a routine today. Like, it's hard because you've been so routine.
You kind of think like, what am I going to do?
Yeah. And, you know, I don't want to sleep until 9 o'clock every day and waste the day. You know, I don't want to be eating breakfast at 10:30, you know, so because I didn't have a schedule, I didn't have to get up if I didn't want to. And I could go to bed late and, you know, so that's been an adjustment.
But didn't that show you that there was a reason why you had that work ethic?
Yeah.
First of all, you wanted the results. And second of all, you had the mindset of someone who was able to do that.
Yeah. And I think I know going forward, whether I play part-time for a few years or whenever I stop playing, I'm going to have to do something that creates a routine, because I think I crave that now. I know that even though, as much as I hated it at points where I didn't want to go and practice and I was making myself go and do it, I think mentally I crave to just have a little bit of routine. I don't think I'll be as a stickler to it like I was at the height of my career, but you know, I will definitely have to have some form of that.
Just touching on that as well, something maybe that's relative to that is, in the press conference after your win, the Craft of Briscoe, now the A&A Inspiration, of course, you sat there with a can of Foster's in your hand and you said that you hadn't really necessarily enjoyed the wins in the past, and this was the first one that you'd really enjoyed and appreciated. Do you stick by that?
Yeah. When I was, you know, arguably the best player in the world and leading the money lists a few years and player of the year and winning majors, if you'd asked me in the heat of all of that if I appreciated it, I would have told you I did. But, and I was only just talking to one of the young Australians the other day about this. You know, I'd win on a Sunday and I might have a tournament the next week, and then the next day it was, that's in the past. You know, how are we going to go about winning this week?
So no party, no enjoyment, no savouring the moment?
No. I wouldn't say I didn't go out and have drinks and stuff. I always did that, but it was like, well, the party after the 2006 Craft Nabisco was one to, I can't even talk about it. It was a mess. We were over at Mikey. Mikey stayed with a bunch of caddies in a house, and I was in a house with all my friends, and we all ended up at that house. And it was a scene of the hangover the next day. It was crazy. But we definitely celebrated that in style.
Okay, but I've read that you said that you were very hard on yourself. Less so as you got older, and it was very tiring. I mean, do you regret then putting so much pressure on yourself, or do you look back and say, well, look at the results I've had?
Yeah, I don't regret it. I don't have regrets of that, but I knew that as the years went on, I didn't like who I was or who I thought I had to be to play well. It was tiring. It was tiring to be so hard on myself and hard on everybody else around me. You know, and expecting excellence from them because I expected it from me. So, you know, I got to a point where I just didn't, you know, if I had to be that person, then I didn't want that. I mean, I still wanted to play well, but I needed to find a way to play well without being that person. I mean, inherently, I'm still that person a little bit. I'm still hard on myself. You know, I slammed my 3-wood into the concrete fairways last week, and now I've got a bit of a sore wrist because of it. So I still have that fire and that passion.
You're a competitor.
But I don't berate myself like I used to. You know, I feel like I'm not hard on the people around me as much.
Okay, well, why were you then?
I think it's all I knew. It was just all I knew. That was just naturally how I decided to handle myself. The best was what I expected, and anything else wasn't good enough. So this will tell you how much I didn't appreciate how well I played for that long period of time. Up until just recently, in the last 5 or 6 years, or might have been 7 or 8 years ago, one of the young Korean players was having top 10 after top 10 after top 10. And they said, you know, the LPGA media ended up saying she's closing in on Kari Webb's top 10 record. I didn't even know I held the top 10 record at 16 top 10s in a row. No idea. And someone said to me, 16 top 10s in a row, that's amazing. And I said, yeah, I said, I didn't even know I had that. And I said, I bet at the time I was pissed off I didn't win more. Like, not appreciating that the consistency of 16 top 10s in a row and how good that is, that I probably only had 4 wins in those 16 tournaments. So I was mad.
Just breaking away from my chat with Kari Webb for a moment to tell you about a superb golf game you can join in with, the Fitstairs Fantasy Masters. Now, apologies to those of you listening in various parts of the globe, but you've got to be a UK resident to enter, and you've got to be 18 years of age as well. Now, it's simple. All you've got to do is pick a 5-man team plus a reserve for the upcoming Masters at Augusta. Now, the winnings of your five players are then added up together, and that makes your final score. Now, there are three different entries for this game. You can play for either a tenner, £100, or £1,000. Now, last year, the £100 game had a prize pot of £140,000. And bear in mind, the winner gets to pocket 40% of the prize pot. Now, you've got to be in the top 25 to win. The website will show you all the prize money breakdown. Now, you can enter more than one team. In fact, enter four, you get a fifth free. You can also share the competition with a friend. If they win, you'll get a percentage too. And you can follow your team's progress on a real-time leaderboard. In the next episode, I'll give you my team, which, let's be honest, you'd probably be better off ignoring. So if you want to get playing, you can do at this address, fantasy.fitzdares.com. That's fantasy.fitzdares.com, where you'll also find the terms and conditions. As with all forms of gambling, make sure you play responsibly and be gamble aware. Now back to the conversation with Curry Webb.
You're listening to the Round Golf Podcast with Richard Kaufman.
You get onto the LPGA Tour and your success is early and fast. First of all, in America, you win on the Futures Tour in Florida. That was only your third professional event in America. You won that by 8 shots. Then 4 months later, you win the Women's British Open. That was before it was a major. You end the year as Rookie of the Year on the LET. Then you qualify for the LPGA Tour, even though I think you had a broken wrist. Is that right?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you win your first LPGA Tour title, just your second start. Then before this little slump we're talking about, before the Craft Nabisco, you won 5 out of 8 majors. I mean, these are incredible numbers, aren't they?
Yeah.
That I'm just rolling off there. I mean, I could go on, but I want to hear from you.
Yeah.
These are incredible. So in a way, that's understandable that top tens are less significant when you've got all these victories and winning. I mean, I don't know. You tell me, it's seemingly coming easy.
Well, definitely, you know, when you're not winning as much, it was coming a lot easier than you know, the odd win here and there. I think what I learnt, you know, when I started to not win as much was how fine a line it is to win. And because I'd never had that sort of, you know, slowdown, I didn't realise that I was just on the other side of that, you know, on the good side of the fine line.
It was the norm.
Yeah, it was. This is what's supposed to happen.
So within this period when you're winning all these majors, of course, a certain Swede comes along called Annika Sorenstam. Now, we talked a little bit about the press and the media before, and of course, I can count myself amongst them, love a rivalry. Mm-hmm. And they wanted this rivalry. And understandably, in terms of your results between you and Annika Sorenstam, how did you feel about that?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely did bring the best out in each other. I appreciate that time competing against her now more than when I was in the thick of it. Annika's been quoted as saying that, you know, my period of golf, 99 and 2000, drove her to start working out and doing the strengthening that she did. And I think, you know, obviously the media wanted this rivalry and neither of us really bit on it. And I never bit on it because I'd already had this tough time with the media and I knew who the bad guy was going to be in this rivalry and I wasn't going to deal with that.
Yeah, I've heard you say that before. Why did you think you were going to be the bad guy?
Just because of the struggles that I'd already had. Annika she'd never really dealt with that. A little bit she did, but when she was criticised for being so stoic on the golf course, she changed and started smiling and started doing all of that stuff. So I knew who the good guy and the bad guy in that rivalry was going to be, and I didn't want to deal with that.
Yeah, I've seen you saying that, you know, Annika changed who she was, and I, you know, I didn't want to do that.
Yeah.
So, you know, you wanted to stay how you were.
Yeah, and I knew that worked for me, so, and I knew that was just me. I wasn't trying to do anything. I was reacting how I naturally would.
In a way, and you're from opposite sides of the planet, you know, you're in Australia, she's from Sweden, but there were similar traits, weren't there, between you, really?
Yes, yeah. As far as how we carried ourselves on the course.
Yeah. So it was kind of interesting that there was that dynamic. You obviously had a great amount of respect for each other. I mean, did you like it? Did you ever socialise with Annika at all?
No, we never really did. I think we wanted to beat each other so bad. It's we hung out in different social circles, so it just never really, you know, amounted to us having any sort of friendship. But you know, we talked a lot when we, well, unless it, if we played, we're paired together Thursday, Friday, we talked a lot. If we were paired together on the weekend, probably was a bit more serious. But, you know, we knew a little bit about each other's families and personal life and stuff like that. So we had a decent time on the golf course. But, you know, like I said, if it was Saturday or Sunday, it was all business.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, her record slightly overshadowed yours, but in hindsight, you look back and what a record you had. But because she was around, yours was made to look almost ordinary in comparison.
Yeah, yeah.
Does that irritate at all? Do you feel totally appreciated?
I don't know. I guess maybe not as much. I think it would be different if I played in a different era. But, I mean, I look at the era before me, and Nancy Lopez overshadowed, you know, Beth Daniel, Betsy King, Pat Bradley, Patty Sheehan, you know, most people know Nancy Lopez from that era, but they don't talk about the others. And I think that era is the greatest era of women's golf. Six or seven of them became Hall of Famers.
Yeah. Okay. So you're quite level-headed, I think, about it, really.
Yeah.
You understand it. What about in Australia itself? I read one of the players, I think Catherine Kirk, saying you're a national hero back home. But do you think women's golf gets, again, like the credit you had against Annika, do you think women's golf gets the credit, say, against the men's? They often say about, you know, so-and-so is one's the most majors or whatever, and yet here you are with seven sometimes being ignored.
I don't think it does. I think it, currently we have more women inside the top 100 than men. I bet most of the golfing public in Australia wouldn't know that. Peter Thompson was always great at pointing out that he thought I was the best player in Australia, because he was always part of the conversation of the best Australian golfer. And he would always say me, which was so nice of him. I don't know why the conversation has to be who's the best. Like, you know, just to be a part of that group is enough. But when Peter Thompson would say stuff like that, you know, people paid attention.
The Olympics. I know you were always a big fan of the Olympics, even as a child. To have missed out on 2016, is that something that still hurts a bit?
Yeah, definitely. It's the first time in my life that I set a goal that I didn't achieve. So I had to really learn to deal with that.
Because in 2000, I think you had a chance of being the first player to break the $2 million barrier mark on the LPGA Tour. Yet you took time off, didn't you? Because you wanted to carry the Olympic torch, Sydney 2000 Olympic Games. Do you remember that?
Well, I remember carrying the torch. I don't remember that could have happened.
The point of me bringing up the money inside of that, which maybe is insignificant to you, is that that's how much it meant to you.
Yeah, yeah. No, just to be a part of that was amazing. Outside of golf, that's probably, or what golf has given me, that's one of the greatest experiences I've ever had.
So that's how much the Olympic Games meant to you.
Yeah.
And then these
at the time, that was my Olympic Games. You know, it was, 9 years later that golf made it into the Olympics. I never saw golf being an Olympic sport.
Sure, but then you had this opportunity and you were there the whole time, and then these young bucks that you've helped along the way, Suho and Minji Lee, they recipients of your scholarship and everything, they come along, of course they want to be there too, and they take your place. And obviously you must be pleased for them, but as you say, this is the first time that you've been denied something that you really wanted.
Yeah, it was. It was very disappointing. I did not watch the golf coverage of the Olympics. I watched other stuff. But, it was hard not to be there. My parents had planned to be there, so they still came and stayed with me in Florida. And I secretly think they wanted to watch the golf to see who won it. But, you know, they knew I didn't want it on the television.
They wish they'd followed Adam Scott, Mark Leishman and Jason Day's path and decided it wasn't for them, and then you know maybe you could have got a chance.
I was glad for both of them. Minji obviously was always going to make it that year, and Sue was playing a rookie year and on the LPGA. You know, she played well enough to be the number two player, and I was excited for her as well.
In terms of people that have been important, we've talked about your caddy, Mikey Patterson, who's alongside you there. There's a guy called Kelvin Haller.
Yeah.
How important has he been throughout your
life?
Yeah,
he's been a huge influence on me. He was, he's still my coach, but he was my first coach.
Since you were eight.
Yeah, so Kelvin, we never had a club professional at the Air Golf Club. So Kelvin was good friends with my parents, and they'd just taken up the game. And he was always out there playing in the afternoon. So that, it was just an informal thing, but they said, Kari wants to play golf. If you see her out there, you know, just make sure she's doing the right stuff. So that was sort of how it started. And he was my only coach through 2003. So through the best part of my career, he was my only coach. And I guess what makes it more significant is that when I was 16, he had, it was an accident, but it was hospital malpractice, became a quadriplegic. So, was very life-changing, but once he, was released and rehabbed and everything, when he came home, we went straight back to where we left off. And because we'd worked together since I was young, he could just communicate what he wanted me to do, and I understood. And, he's been a huge inspiration to me because he didn't give up on life because of what circumstances he was under. And he's coaching my niece now. He's still coaching, and I think, it's just fantastic to watch him do that.
Okay, and I know that's another part of what you've been doing. You've helped raise a lot of money, haven't you, in those circles, as well as obviously what you do with your scholarship too?
Yeah, I've been involved with the Christopher Reeve Foundation, it's the Christopher and Dana Reeve Foundation now, since it started in 1998. I'd sort of told myself that I must have just had this intuition that I was gonna be somewhat successful at golf, and I'd always told myself if I was, that was what I wanted to be involved in. And right around the time I was playing my first LPGA Skins game, part of our winnings at the Skins game had to go to a charity of our choice, and at that stage I didn't have a charity, so I was in the process of trying to find a paralysis foundation to donate to, and Chris and Dana were on the cover of People magazine talking about their new foundation. So I chose their foundation and I think donated 10 or 20,000 from the Skins game. And because they'd only just started, it was one of the largest individual donations. So they wanted to know who I was, what my story was, why I wanted to be involved. And because I think they obviously had lots of donors that, were Superman fans, and that's why they donated. They wanted to know if I was in it for the right reasons, and how it was. So we started a charity pro-am that we did for 3 or 4 years, and since then, I've just been a part of, this year I donated a caddy experience. So it was in an online auction, and someone bid to caddy for me for the day during a pro-am, which was a lot of fun. And so I've just been doing stuff like that to stay connected.
Fantastic. And just to finalise, going back to that round, you jumping into Mikey's arms, would you like that to be the image that people remember you as a golfer as? Would that be the moment, or would it be something else?
Yeah, no, I'd say that would be the moment. I would say that's how I feel inside, even if I don't show it. So when I let that out, I'd like people to think of that.
That was the real carry word.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know about you, but as I've said in previous podcasts, in this series alone, I've had the chance to speak to someone like Gary Player, in Kari Webb here as well. We're talking Hall of Famers, Davis Love, legends in the game. I didn't know Kari that well before I interviewed her, but I did feel like she opened up there, and it was a great insight into being at the very top of your sport and what you've got to do to maintain that level that these golfers get to. Fascinating listen, I thought. Really good insight. What did you think? Let me know at The Round Podcast on Twitter, at The Round Golf Podcast on Facebook. Love to get some feedback from you. It'd be great to hear your thoughts on that. Until next time, I'll see you soon.